Let's run through the open fracture bow, shall we?
Sure, let's do it.
So let's talk about inclusions, Pete.
So the inclusions for the bow open fractures is everything except hand and foot, essentially, and wrist fractures. So anything that's open that's not hand, wrist, or foot needs to go to an orthoplastic center. Now, usually that's a level one trauma center or major trauma center, as we call them in this country. But there are some centers that have plastic surgery and orthopedics, and those are also orthoplastic centers. One of the thing which I think is quite brave is they've said antibiotics, IV antibiotics, have to be given within 1 hour of the injury, not arrival in hospital, 1 hour of injury.
It's punchy.
That is punchy. Yeah. And so what, of course, that has done is it's driven that pre-hospital.
Yeah.
So now the paramedics are giving IV antibiotics at scene when they suspect there's been an open fracture.
Which antibiotic?
It's usually IV co-amoxiclav, but it can be whatever that trauma network has decided.
Fine. So they're carrying that around. They whack that in as soon as they get there.
Yep.
And that's why you talk about your ABC of open fractures.
Exactly, ABC. What does A stand for?
Not airway. I've played this game before.
Of course, it's always antibiotics.
Always antibiotics. Whack it in.
Yeah. And of course, that's got to be a good thing. Now, we're never going to prove it. It's very difficult to prove that's one of those things of like it's never going to be evidence-based that. It's a bit like using binders for pelvic fractures. You're never going to prove that it works, but it just so intuitively seems right that you just go ahead and do it.
It's like doing a randomized controlled trial of whether parachutes work or not.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Half of you jump out without and see who survives.
Exactly.
So what happens when the patient arrives? So obviously that's pre-hospital.
It's a major trauma, so there's other things going on. There's the tranexamic piece and putting on pelvic binders, etc., which is another podcast separately.
Fine.
When they get there, that there is the routine reception. So you're not allowed to. We don't want to be doing surgical debridements in the ED, but you are allowed to wash off obvious large contaminants. So if a wound is absolutely filthy, then giving it a wash with some saline is the right thing to
do. If there's a bit of bark in there or something off the road,
or toenail or something, you're
pick it out.
Just pick it out.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah,
okay.
But going in with like fetch the forceps and pulling out like bits of stuff and tugging it on soft tissues is not something you're going to be doing in ED.
Understood.
Obviously, taking a photograph, getting your plastic surgeons involved is really important. So letting them know that this is here, here's what the wound looks like, so everyone's on the same page and everyone is kind of coalescing on that first primary debridement procedure.
And that photo is key, right? Because you don't want to keep exposing it.
And no, absolutely right.
I would encourage all the juniors listening to make sure that photo is uploaded to your electronic record.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when we do our trauma meetings, we have the x-rays and imaging on one side and we have the clinical photos on the other side.
Yeah.
And the worst time is when it's on someone's phone and it's being passed around the department.
Yeah, yeah.
For lots of reasons.
Yeah, exactly. Saline dressing, tetanus, and then get a splint on, and then you're firing up theatre and you're trying to get that done as soon as possible.
So you basically put on a wet piece of saline and then you splint it, right? So you immobilize the fracture.
Yeah.
Whack in the tetanus and off you go.
Yep.
Nice.
And so the next one is primary debridement. So this is the first operation they get, the first washout. And the BOST guidelines as they stand say that for low energy open fractures, this would be a grade 1 or a grade 2, which is not particularly contaminated, is not particularly high energy, then waiting for 24 hours, getting it done within 24 hours is okay. But for higher energies, for grade 3s, they want it done under 12 hours. And for very contaminated injuries, like
I love these. Come on, give us the list.
So it's agricultural injuries.
Yeah.
It's basically feces and pond water.
Yeah. So agricultural, aquatic, and sewage.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or the really grim ones. Or just very, very muddy. Or the other one that you sometimes see in inner cities is train injuries, specifically trains, because the oil from the train gets baked into the whole surgical field. Getting rid of oil is miserable. It's just, it's a really miserable operation.
We see a lot of that, don't we?
Yeah, we do.
And
yeah.
The other time you're there to go straight to theatre if there's vascular compromise.
Absolutely.
So compartment syndrome or an arterial injury causing ischemia.
Yeah.
And they have to go straight to theatre.
Absolutely.
And then you've got to bring your timings forward.
Yeah. Agreed. And those timings, so contaminated straight away, high energy within 12, low energy within 24, that again, is aspirational. We don't always achieve that. But actually, the Goliath study, which has been, the Goliath group, I should say, is a research, a multi-center research group in the US who've been looking at open fractures. And they've come down very much in line with this, saying that, you know, for low energy fractures, it probably doesn't matter getting to theatre early. But for higher energy or contaminated ones, getting to theatre within 12 hours definitely seems to make a difference.
Tell me about this first debridement.
So the first debridement is your orthopod and your plastic surgeon are coming in there and looking at the wound and making an evaluation. Mm. They are deciding how to extend the wound, and we tend to do that along fasciotomy lines. So that's the first thing in a debridement, is to extend the wound.
Actually, I must say the practical that you do at our master's summer school with the cadavers,
yeah,
with the open fracture debridement. You think, you know, debridement, but actually it's a skill. It's a really undervalued skill.
It's difficult. Yeah.
People think we just wash it out, rinse it, take 1 millimeter off the skin edges,
yeah,
and send that off.
And you're done.
And you're,
yeah,
done. But it's not. You, yeah, really go out there delivering the ends and really getting every piece and speck of dust and,
exactly,
mud out of there, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It takes ages. And you'd be absolutely methodical. You'd work your way around, like a clock face around the wound, in order to get everything out.
And tell me this, you know, when you're washing it.
Yeah.
So this is a question that always gets asked, right? Some, yeah, people use a saline giving set,
yep,
and are doing a low pressure. Someone squeezing a bag like they're playing a bagpipe.
Yeah.
And some people are looking for the pulse lavage, giving it the old Rambo.
Yep.
But a lot of people say, well, the pulse lavage is a concern because it's going to be washing infection upstream, up the tissues into the, you know, away from,
yes,
the fracture.
Yeah. And there was always a lot of concern. And there always is a lot of, people have opinions on things. When there's not enough evidence, people take opinions and they say, oh, well, I believe this and I believe that. It's only when you get Mo Bhandari, yeah, like doing a randomized control trial across over 2,000 patients, now you've got your answer.
Yeah.
And the flow trial did exactly that. And, yeah, they showed that there was no difference whether you use a pulse lavage on high flow, low flow, or just doing the bagpipes, as you know, or a giving set just coming down and just, yeah, flowing on ultra, so-called ultra-low pressure. They're all exactly the same. And they also showed that, in fact, saline was superior, not equivalent, superior to using what's called Castile soap, which is like a soap solution,
yeah,
for washing out wounds. So in general, so it's saline. Give saline, but use whatever you like. And most hospitals now have edited out pulse lavage because it's quite expensive. You know, it's much more expensive than a giving set, and there's no real benefit to it.
The other thing that's quite interesting in these BOST guidelines is number 13, that once, yep, debridement is complete, that you really should, if you're doing anything else at the same sitting, it needs to be clean surgery. So new instruments, a new prep and drape of the limb before proceeding.
Absolutely, yeah. So you start again. So you finish your debridement. Okay, we're clean now. Now you totally redrape and you almost like start again if you're doing a tibial nail, or if you're doing, yeah, doing a reconstructive operation, a so-called fix and flap, or if you've primarily closed it and you're doing your instrumentation. Absolutely right.
So that's your first debridement.
Yep.
And then at that point, Assuming you've not fixed it definitively, right?
Yeah.
Most likely the patient for 3B will have an X fix on.
Yes.
And most likely a negative pressure vacuum dressing.
Yeah. Now, it's not always that case. So in Bristol, they also like using damage control plates instead of X fixes. That's definitely an option. So you can just put a little, like, you know, 6-hole plate across the tibial, for open tibial fracture. That's not your definitive fix. Actually, it's just to hold it steady. You then put your vac on top of that. And then, yes, you come back later on, you take that plate off. And all of the screws that were holding it together, you take that all off. And any cortical fragments you've lagged in at the same time, that all comes out. Wash, throw away the metalwork. And then you do your definitive fixation, whatever that looks like.
But let's be honest, that's not the standard treatment of care across most trauma centers.
It's not, but it is a well-recognized strategy for temporizing fixation. Some people use X fixes. Some people use damage control plates. Both are completely legitimate. What you mustn't do, as stated in the guidelines, what you mustn't do is fix without any soft tissue cover. So putting a nail in and then waiting a few days before you put your soft tissue cover on, that's really what they're trying to get us away from. Mm. It's certainly something we used to do all the time. You know, orthopods would nail the thing, they'd stick a vac on, and they'd stand back and they go, right, plastics, over to you.
X-rays look great.
X-rays look great. And the plastic go, well, we haven't actually got a list until, and a surgeon until, yeah, like next Tuesday. So, okay, fine, well, let's just leave the vac on. And we know that vacs get colonized on their undersurface within 24, 48 hours. Yeah. They're not a sterile. You think when you're putting them on, they're sterile, and they are, but they don't stay sterile for long at all.
So we've done our debridement. We've put an X-Fix on. We put a vac on.
Yeah.
And the patient goes back to the ward.
Yeah.
When are they coming back?
They're coming back when the orthoplastics, a definitive care is going to happen. And so that requires some liaison. It requires the two specialties working together to decide when they're going to do it. And it takes a lot of the day, because the orthopods have to do that. Let's say it's a tibial nail, which is the easy bit in some respects. The plastics have to raise a flap and put it on the wound once the nail is down. So that's often a whole day's sport.
But Bosch tells us what the guideline should be.
It's within 72 hours. The aspiration is to get it all done within 72 hours.
Perfect.
Fix and flap.
And what happens, Pete, if it goes on beyond 72 hours?
It's okay. If it goes on beyond 72 hours, it goes on. You know, some patients get sick. Sometimes you don't have the manpower. Sometimes you don't have the OR time. But if it goes on beyond 72 hours, for every day it goes on beyond 72, your infection rate increases, and it's been estimated it goes up by about 4% each day beyond 72 hours. So each day you go on, you're just slowly jacking up your infection rate by around 4%, and that will grow slowly, exponentially over time. So that 4 will become 6, will become, you know, higher and higher until it reaches a point where your infection rates are around about 30-40%.
And as Pete said, it's important that the definitive internal fixation has to be accompanied by definitive soft tissue cover.
Exactly. In these guidelines. Now, that's not everyone's practice around the world. A lot of people don't have plastics on site, and so they are mandated to fix it and then send it to another center where they get their soft tissue cover. So that is still practiced around the world. Mm. But by providing a guideline for the whole nation that states that you've got to fix and flap at the same time, that is a lever for change, as we were saying at the beginning. So it's for some centers, they couldn't do it to begin with. But it's a lever for change. So now, years down the line, they are able to do it because they were able to push their managers and their institutions to accommodate these new guidelines.
Now, the challenging bit is when you are making a decision about limb salvage or amputation.
Amputation is difficult because you're looking at a in the emergency department, it's often quite hard to assess these legs because there's a lot of mess. There's blood everywhere. You can't really get a really good. You don't get a good look at it until you're under GA, and the patient may well be conscious when they come in. Mm. And you say, well, we're going to have a look at your leg, and if your foot's not viable, we may have to take it off. And so,
but a lot of these are high energy trauma. A lot of these patients are tubed, chest drains in.
Oh, that's certainly true. So if you have an obtunded patient, then absolutely, I think the right thing to do is to do the debridement and you're taking the leg off if it's completely non-viable. However, if the patient is actually you're going to wake them up after the surgery, or if they've got relatives who you can easily access, actually having that discussion with them, so doing your first debridement, getting it all clean, knowing that you're going to be almost certainly throwing this leg in the bin because it's not going to survive, but waking them up, leaving the leg on for now, even though it may even be like half dead, leaving the leg on for a bit, waking them up, having that discussion with the patient, say, look, I don't think we're going to be able to preserve your leg. I really don't think. And letting them be part of the decision making, or let them just talk with their relatives. That is actually really helpful for them psychologically down the line.
Yeah.
People who wake up with no leg, they didn't really feel like they had a choice in it. People struggle with that.
And some people just don't want to let it go. Some people do persist or insist on trying to salvage the leg no matter what.
Yes.
And yet actually we know from the LEAP study and the various other things, we know that can store up years and years of misery.
So yeah, that's right. Trying to preserve an unsalvageable limb, or a limb you can preserve, but it's always going to be really unsatisfactory. It's always going to be painful, insensate, susceptible to soft tissue breakdown, or it's going to have a fixed equinus contracture for the rest of your life. If preserving a leg that's going to be no good isn't necessarily in the patient's best interests. So, but if you can, get the patient to almost choose amputation, accepting in that early stage. And they say in the Boast guidance, ideally, you should need to try and get that amputation done within 72 hours. Mm. So it goes with the sort of that's your definitive soft tissue cover, isn't it? Yeah. And fixation is a beacon.
Folding the stump over.
Yeah. If you can get the patient on side with that, that is really good for them psychologically. You definitely don't want patients to become emotionally invested in preserving an unsalvageable limb.
And just to round off these Boast guidelines, the last two things. One is about how the trauma network should submit their data to TARN.
Yeah.
Just one line, what is TARN?
Trauma Audit Research Network. So this is basically just all of the level one trauma centers in the UK linking up and putting data into one, all their data into one database, so that we can compare the results of one institution versus all of the others.
And then berate them.
Well, to a certain extent, no, it's a little bit name and shame, actually. Yeah. So all of the results are there for everyone to see. I can see where we stand compared with every single other level one trauma center.
Delete that. And then the last line, which I respect the last point in the Boast guideline. All patients should, I'm going to read this one because this is important. All patients should receive information regarding expected functional recovery and rehabilitation, including advice about return to normal activities such as work and driving.
Yeah.
And that's probably the one bit where the whole trauma thing falls down in the country.
I think, so in the UK, we are good at that immediate early reception of patients and doing the right thing by legs and having low infection rates, etc. So that side is good. The back side is not so good. Our rehab in the UK is poor, and the way patients are kind of left to their own devices after they get treated in hospitals. So their outpatient treatment is generally quite poor. Yeah. Not that they don't get seen in clinic, they do. But you know, the access to physiotherapy for people who can't afford private care is very slim.
And I would agree, your backside is not good.
There are a whole ton of other things to open fractures, like antibiotics, nails, the rights and wrongs of vac dressing, how to debride a wound. All of that is part of the discussion around open fractures, and we're not going to cover it in this podcast. But come and join our bastards and learn about it.
I thought you said join our bastards.
Okay.
Didn't something say join our bastards? Yeah, Dave said that as well.
But come and join our masters and hear all about it.
I can't take any more of this. I just want to go home and dream about meniscus repairs. So if you like this and you want to find out more about our QMUL, QIML, QIML, Masters Program, you can find us on Twitter, AuthorMasters, or follow the links below. Applications are open now for October 23 entry. Come study with Pete and I and a whole team of orthopods and educators. Not a leather elbow patch in sight. It'll be epic.
And that, folks, is the end of part one of episode one of our new Ortho Masters podcast. Join us next week for part two, where we conclude the topic.